Young, it's here and now. Wall Street is still jittery following a tumble in worldwide markets overnight, which in turn followed yesterday's plunge, the second largest drop on Wall Street in 4 years. That was due in large part to a report from the Mortgage Bankers Association on the collapse in the market of risky or subprime home loans. The report showed that one in every 200 U.S. home money borrowers suffered foreclosure in the last quarter of last year. That's the highest rate in nearly four decades of surveys. Well, joining us on the line from New York is Wall Street Journal reporter Mark Whitehouse. Mark, tell us briefly what happens with these subprime home loans and how is that affecting the entire market?
Well, to some extent, this is what one would expect to happen after a long period in which easy money provided an incentive for lenders to make a lot of bad loans, because the more loans they made, the more money they made.
And what kind of, when you say bad loans, these were loans to people who perhaps couldn't afford a high interest rate or a big down payment?
Precisely. The incentive was that if you are a mortgage lender, you can allow somebody to take out a mortgage with no money down, specifically because you can go and sell that loan, or that is the right to collect the payments on that loan to Wall Street, for more money than you put out.
So these loans, these risky loans, were then turned around and packaged as financial deals, and they sort of spread exponentially through the market.
Yeah, Wall Street has repackaged these loans in many ways and sold them to investors all over the world, Europe, Asia.
And so what happens? These buyers who took on these riskier loans, what happens to lead to failure?
What's happened is, first, the housing market in many parts of the United States started to slow down. First sales slowed, then prices started to fall. And when prices fall, a lot of people who took out mortgages with no money down find themselves owing more on the mortgage than their house is worth. In that kind of a situation, it's logical for many of them to walk away and not pay the loan.
Right.
And
so
let the bank take the house.
Right. And but now it's not maybe the lender's bank, it's the bank that the lender sold the mortgage to.
Precisely.
Right. Well, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said the situation is distressing to individual mortgage holders, but it was anticipated and it's largely contained. It sounds like it's not contained. It sounds like it's affecting a larger area.
Well, what has really shocked investors, I think, is the speed and intensity with which this has happened. Of course, I mean, to some extent, this could have been expected. When sales volumes and prices fall, weaker builders and lenders start to go out of business. But in the past several weeks, mortgage lenders have been going out of business at a rate of about two a week, which is a lot, and a lot for investors to swallow. The economic story is something that developed in slightly slower motion. There are two big questions for the economy. One is, how much farther will home prices fall as all these foreclosed houses come onto the market, and how will that affect people's psychology and consumer spending? Another is, how will investors react as bad news keeps coming in? If they pull back from all kinds of lending, then that could lead to the kind of credit crunch that has triggered recessions in the past.
Explain that a little further. For instance, let's say you have nothing to do with the subprime market. You didn't make one of these risky loans. You didn't take one of these risky loans. But in the late spring, you were thinking of taking out, let's say, an equity loan on your house to pay for your kids' college or just have some extra cash. How will this news affect you?
Well, in a sort of worst-case scenario, it could affect not only people who want to take out a home equity loan. It could affect people who want to get credit cards. It could affect people who want to buy cars. It could affect companies that want to borrow money to expand their operations. Over the past several years, investors have been extremely willing to lend money at very low rates to companies, to automakers, to tech companies, to credit card companies that then go on and lend those money to people. If investors decide that this problem in the subprime market is a sign that the credit of American consumers is bad, they could decide that they want to stay away from all those kinds of investments, and that would leave less money for people to borrow.
So money could be tight for everybody, whether or not you had anything to do with this subprime market.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are analysts saying? And we hear lawmakers making some noise, too. What do you think is down the road?
Well, what happens in Washington is very important right now, because it could exacerbate the situation with lending. If regulation proves to be too heavy-handed, they could cut off money from people who deserve to get credit, who deserve to get loans. That's something that remains to be seen. Although it does seem that some of the lawmakers who are considering legislation to bring lenders back into line do recognize the dangers involved as well.
Mark Whitehouse, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Mark, thanks so much.
Okay.
What is going on in Washington? We want to take a few minutes to find out. First of all, to the latest firestorm surrounding Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who today again defended his department's decision to fire 8 U.S. attorneys and also turned aside calls for his resignation, saying he wants to stay and explain to Congress the circumstances surrounding the dismissal of the attorneys. Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He joins us from Washington for an extended look at the overall power grid there, but again, starting with Gonzalez. Richard, how big is this story in Washington, and has there been a partisan or, you know, not bipartisan response to it?
Well, I think initially it was fairly partisan in the sense that a lot of this was driven by liberal blog attention, and it was very easy for conservatives and Republicans to just dismiss it as something about nothing. But since the initial response from the administration has proved to be wholly wrong, and there has been a pretty bipartisan reaction, especially to this sight of the administration not just lying about what happened, but also seeking to avert the attention of Congress, to try and go around Congress with some of these new appointments of U.S. attorneys. It seems quite clear from the emails that were released between the Justice Department and the White House that they wanted to circumvent Congress, and that's one thing guaranteed to get Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill worked up.
Well, let's remind ourselves of the story, because as you say, to the firings themselves, critics say that they were politically motivated. Last week, the White House said they only knew about the firings right before they happened a year ago. But as you say, the emails that were printed yesterday in the Washington Post revealed that White House counsel Harriet Myers and Gonzalez's then chief of staff Kyle Sampson were talking about these firings 2 years ago. So as you say, that, you know, lie is a pretty strong word, but it would seem as if at least someone in the White House knew about them. Yesterday, Gonzalez said in response to this accusation, how could you not know about this? He said the Justice Department is big, lots of employees, tough to stay on top of everything. But here's what he told Matt Lauer today on the Today Show when he was asked, how could you not know that this issue was being discussed by your chief of staff and the White House counsel? Let's listen.
I was certainly aware of the fact that the early communication between Harriet Myers and my chief of staff about removing all U.S. attorneys, and that was, I immediately rejected that. Then directed Kyle Sampson to do an evaluation of U.S. attorneys. I think we have an obligation to ensure where we can improve on performance around the country.
And to remind ourselves, Harriet Myers, the counsel, the White House counsel, had suggested removing all 93 AGs. But to the fact that Gonzalez was saying that he was certainly aware of things, parse this for us. Does this sound different from what he said yesterday?
Well, it edges it forward a little bit, but frankly, it's still totally undercut by his own chief of staff's emails. I mean, this wasn't a management review process. It's quite clear that there was a game plan mapped out where they would, in public, make the argument that it was all about performance. But the real agenda was to push people out they didn't like. It wasn't driven by concerns about an individual's management style or them not meeting certain expectations. It was driven by political concerns filtered through the White House, taken to the Justice Department, or in some cases just having their own former employees, White House employees, wanting to get a plum job as a U.S. attorney. Yes, it takes it slightly further forward in the sense that Gonzalez is now not pretending that his chief of staff was just one of 110,000 employees. It was his chief of staff.
Well, let's remind ourselves, because it is not unusual for presidents to remove prosecutors at the beginning of their terms. Bill Clinton did it. But what is unusual about this? Is it that it was, you know, so far into President Bush's term? Is it in his second term?
It's not unusual for a new president to have new appointees at any part of the government. but it is highly unusual for a president to remove his own appointees, his own political appointees, halfway through the second term. I mean, you could make the case that a new president, a re-elected president, could have a clear out at the start of his second term, but not halfway through that second term, and certainly not in anything more than individual cases. You're looking at the volume and the timing both being highly suspicious.
Well, and where do you think it's going to go, Richard Wolff?
This is a political problem, not a legal problem. There's nothing illegal. They weren't abusing their power. What they've done is trampled over the arm's-length relationship that has traditionally existed between the White House and the Justice Department, at least since the Nixon era. And there's a reason for that, a reason that Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez identified in his confirmation hearing, which is that at Justice, you're not just serving the White House, you're serving the American people and justice in general. So there has to be an appearance of impartiality. That clearly wasn't held to in this case. So there's a political problem, not just among Democrats, but among Republicans too, especially, as I said, the way they tried to circumvent Congress here. The reason you have a confirmation process is so that the appearance of partisan maneuvering is avoided. You get the congressional branch to buy into this. And they used the Patriot Act, provisions of the Patriot Act, to make sure that Congress was not involved. And that's one guaranteed way to get Republicans and Democrats annoyed. And that's what we're seeing.
Well, and we're reminded that this is the second time in as many weeks that Gonzalez has come under fire for that. Last week, he and FBI Director Robert Mueller admitted that the FBI had improperly and at times illegally used the USA Patriot Act to pry out personal information about Americans in terrorism investigations. And you're saying that according to the emails, this isn't conjecture, yeah, according to the emails that were printed, that were written by his chief of staff, Sampson, the thinking was to use the Patriot Act again regarding these attorneys general, even though did they have anything to do with counterterrorism?
No, absolutely nothing. We're talking about voter fraud cases, immigration cases, nothing to do with terrorism.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. I tell you what, Richard, we had planned to talk to you this week about your current thinking about the tone in the White House and how it may be a new tone reflected by new Defense Secretary Robert Gates. I want to ask you when we come back how this story and Alberto Gonzalez's handling of it may be slightly out of step with what is apparently or seemingly a new face of the White House. We'll do that. We'll do a compare and contrast when we come back. Richard Wolff, again, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. Be right back after a quick break. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Richard, we had been talking about the controversy surrounding Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and the firing of eight federal prosecutors. But I want to ask you about the difference, if you see a difference, between the way this situation is being handled by Mr. Gonzalez and the way, say, the Walter Reed Medical Center situation had been handled by Defense Secretary Robert Gates, and you know, more about what seems, and as you write, might be somewhat the new face of the White House, and that face being Bob Gates.
Yeah, well, there's a huge difference. When the Walter Reed story broke, Gates promised President Bush that there will be high-level accountability, and in fact, we have seen that. People have lost their jobs, high-level people have lost their jobs. The Army Secretary, the Surgeon General, the Commander in Charge of Walter Reed. These are big figures within the military to lose their jobs in very short order. What you have with Gonzalez is something slightly different. Yes, someone's lost his job as Chief of Staff, but Gonzalez is still trying to have it both ways. He says, I take full responsibility for what happened, but I also stand by the decision. And you don't have that same doublespeak going on and inside the Defense Department, where Gates has really pursued this. And people who haven't pursued this with as much vigor as he has have lost their jobs.
In fact, you quote him as saying in a news conference after the firing of the Army Secretary, some have shown too much defensiveness and have not shown enough focus on digging into and addressing the problems. And as you say, a defense secretary who admits that his top officials were too defensive, that's new. Because there's another compare and contrast with, of course, Donald Rumsfeld.
That's right. And look at how he handled Abu Ghraib. Really, you're looking at much lower-level people being held to account for it. And Rumsfeld's initial reaction, and I think it appealed to something in President Bush, was to push back and say this was just a minor event. And in the case of Abu Ghraib, Rumsfeld said he was just surprised that people had digital cameras and were taking photos of this. So, you know, a very different response, and I think a very different period for the administration.
Well, but as you also write, a very different period, and we want to sort of paint that picture broader. You write, Rumsfeld gone, Dick Cheney marginalized after the Scooter Libby trial and also, you know, his own illness. And also a perception that he's being, you know, there's an end run going on with Condoleezza Rice perhaps coming to the fore with her foreign policy initiatives. And you ask, has President Bush himself gone soft, become a touchy-feely multilateralist? The answer is no, that the change in the Bush administration is more a matter of style than substance. Is Gates just a new style?
Well, Gates does have a new style, but look at the real questions of substance here. Iraq policy, Gates is fully on board with the surge, the so-called surge in Iraq, the extra troops going there. And he's also been very supportive, as we report, of saber-rattling with Iran, where actually the administration thinks they've been successful in bringing Iran to the negotiating table. So he supports the direction of the policy, but as we point out, these differences in style can lead to changes in substance over time, and we're certainly seeing a very different tone and action in terms of how they've responded to Walter Reed.
Well, how would that play out, for instance, with Condoleezza Rice? I mean, some have said that there's been an end run and that he's enabled that. He's sort of like, you know, placed a block so that she could end run neoconservatives like Dick Cheney.
Well, here's one way things are different. Donald Rumsfeld took a very expansive view of what his responsibility was. In the bureaucracy's language, he strayed out of his lane repeatedly and vigorously to try and shape, successfully, as it turned out from his perspective, a foreign policy, not just defense policy, but foreign policy. Gates is sticking to his lane, so he doesn't actually get involved in this. That itself removes a big block to the State Department shaping the policy on things like Iran and North Korea, where previously Rumsfeld was a very strong voice opposing what then Secretary of State Colin Powell was doing. Rumsfeld had this close relationship with Dick Cheney. The two of them worked closely together. Again, a different point of time. The president, I'm told reliably by his senior aides, is just not as reliant on Dick Cheney as he used to be. And Dick Cheney has fewer allies in the administration, not just people like Rumsfeld, but lower down people, the former UN ambassador, for instance, John Bolton, was a very close ally. And these voices, these very strong characters, are no longer there. So Cheney has less levers to pull, if you will.
And how much is Gates involved in the fact that there have been talks with North Korea, talks, as we saw, as minimal as they were, with Iran? Or was that Condoleezza Rice on her own, you know, is and running Cheney?
She really has her own freedom here. She has a direct relationship with the president. He trusts her. And I'm told, again, people who are close to Cheney and people who are close to the president, that she's able to execute her own policy now because the president trusts her. So this is really Condoleezza Rice is doing more than Robert Gates.
How much further does it go? What do you envision on the horizon with about a minute and a half left?
In terms of policy, look, their biggest challenge is Iraq still, and it doesn't really matter what Condoleezza Rice does. What she really wants to do is try and work on the Middle East, and the question is, does she have the time and commitment to do it, and is the president willing to change his attitude towards some of the key players in the region, especially a group like Hamas?
You write, Gates is emblematic of a less hubristic administration, but undoubtedly too much of a realist himself to think he can miraculously salvage history's verdict on this presidency. Obviously, you have you come to the table with an opinion. What do you think he can help on in the couple years left?
Well, he, like the new chief of staff in the White House, Josh Bolton, is a pragmatist. He's a results-driven person. And what you're seeing is much more focused on a sort of professional management structure. Accountability is part of that, but his support for Petraeus, the new commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, his much happier relationship with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, all of these things point to a more professional approach, so that's where it's really going to change.
Richard Wolff, Senior White House Correspondent for Newsweek Magazine, with just a touchdown in Washington as it continues to percolate along today. Richard, thank you so much.
Anytime.
And don't forget, later in the program today, still ahead, if you're sending a kid to college, did you know many U.S. colleges are now offering co-ed dorm rooms? But for some unique reasons, we'll explain much more coming up here and now. Fun Young, It's Here and Now. Come September, Clark University here in Massachusetts will join roughly 30 schools across the country, allowing male and female students to room together in dorm rooms. To which we said, say what? Joining us is Jeffrey Chang, co-founder of the National Student Gender Blind Campaign, which advocates for gender-neutral policies on college campuses. He's a junior at Clark, and he helped lead the campaign to change that school's policy. Jeffrey, why did you get involved in this issue?
It started off as a very pragmatic issue. You know, I needed someone to live with. My friend needed someone to live with. And at the end of the day, we looked at each other and said, why can't we live together?
Well, the answer was, she's a she.
Exactly. I mean, it was as simple as her gender and my gender.
Were you romantically connected at all?
No, not at all. We were, you know, just best friends. You know, we live right next door to each other. We shared similar eating patterns, sleeping patterns, you know, same interest in music. You know, we hung out all the time. And we were just very compatible in terms of living together.
Well, now, let me just ask, because this is where, for some people, it would get to, that sounds lovely. Who hasn't had a best friend of another gender? Mm-hmm. However, living together is another thing. In those tiny little dorm rooms, was there concern about, you know, being in your boxer shorts in front of each
right.
other? I mean,
you know, we happened to be very close, and, you know, that wasn't an issue at all.
Hmm. So you went to the school and outlined your reasoning, and it worked. What was your reasoning?
Well, our reasoning was just this double standard. The fact that, you know, two roommates of the same sex, you know, can without any barrier just walk into housing and say they wanted to live together. But because we were of a different gender, you know, that was the only thing that was keeping us back.
In fact, you call this institutionalized heterosexism.
Right, institutionalized heterosexism, which is basically the assumption that all the students are heterosexual, and that if men and women want to live together, that automatically assumes that they're going to have sex or they're in a relationship. And, you know, that clearly is not the case.
When, in fact, one of your concerns is that it might be tough for someone who is gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, mm-hmm. intersexed, mm-hmm. or just not sure, mm-hmm. to suddenly be... By the way, what's intersexed?
Intersex is basically someone who is born with ambiguous genitalia. So biologically, it might not be clear if they are male or female.
And it might be very difficult for them to be forced to room with someone of the same gender. And it might be very difficult for them to explain why they don't want to.
Right, absolutely. And I think the reason why we wanted this policy in place is so that they didn't have to come out and you know, openly have to declare themselves.
Well, and then some would ask, but doesn't that also set up someone for being outed if they choose this kind of a situation?
Right. Well, at Clark and most of the schools with gender-neutral housing, anyone is able to enter into this option. And in fact, many of the gender-neutral pairs that have gone into this that have been widely covered in the media happen to be just, you know, straight, heterosexual male and female friends. You know, so it's a wide range of people who are entering into this. So we don't feel that just because there is a different gender roommate pair that automatically means that they're gay, lesbian, or transgender.
Right. What would you say to the people who have a different sense, maybe of a different generation,
right,
who
right.
are thinking, geez, this is just going to be about people who date, they're never going to get their work
right,
done,
right,
distractions,
right.
or worse, maybe,
right.
you know, abusive situations if
uh-huh.
there's a man and a woman. What would you say?
Well, I think like the title of your show, Here and Now, I mean, this is a very here and now issue. Colleges have always been at the forefront of social change, and I think we're beginning to recognize as a society that, you know, men and women are interacting far more than they have 20, 30, 40 years ago, and the genders are no longer a mystery. It's far more likely that schools have co-ed floors, co-ed suites and apartments. I mean, this is just simply the next step in that evolution.
Jeffrey Chang is co-founder of the National Student Gender Blind Campaign. They advocate for gender-neutral policies on college campuses. He's a junior at Clark University, which is going to institute his campaign next September. Jeffrey, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, is this going to come in time for you?
Yes, this will, actually. It's funny because we just got our housing lottery information, and as I said earlier, it's a very pragmatic choice. You know, I might choose to live in an apartment or off campus or in a single. So
after all that.
After all that.
Well, in fact, let's just touch on that. This will not be available for freshmen.
Right.
It'll
right.
only be available for upperclassmen, and most of them will choose to live in an apartment or a suite or off campus.
Right, absolutely. Very few students ultimately go into it, but I think that the main point is that to have the option is more important than ever.
Jeffrey Chang, thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Well, Steve Water is Senior Associate Dean of Haverford College. He's also the Dean of Student Life there. Haverford has had gender-blind housing in the form of suites that have different gender rooms in them since the 80s, but they've had these gender-blind dorm rooms since the year 2000. And I'm wondering, Dean Water, do you think it works?
I think it works well. I've found that for the students living in rooms with members of the opposite sex, there are just as few or just as many issues that come up as in the single sex. Mm.
Well, what were some of the concerns before you started, and what did you do to avoid things? I mean, what were some of the rules that you put in?
The concerns are many, and one is, are students going to somehow abuse the privilege? Are students who are in romantic relationships going to be the only ones who are going to be opting for this? What are the parents going to say? Is it going to create some negative publicity for the college? These are all kinds of things that any college would take into account.
And what did you find? Did kids opt for these rooms for romantic reasons?
I'm sure some did, but one of the driving forces behind moving to gender-neutral housing was our lesbian, bisexual, gay, transgendered student group that said, you know, we want to be able to live with our friends. And some of our friends are members of the opposite sex, and we'd like to live with whom we'd spend the year with.
Well, what would you do if a parent didn't want their child to be with a roommate of the opposite sex? Would they have a say in that matter?
I think parents always have a say. I think ultimately our approach would be to facilitate a conversation between the student and the parent.
Well, Haverford is a relatively small school.
Yes.
Do you think it's because you're a smaller school and you can keep an eye on people who seem to have some of the same ethics mm-hmm. that it will work better than at a large school?
I think, I don't know if the size is the issue, but I think the institutional culture is important. It's, I don't know if it's the only factor, but I think here it's an important factor. Haverford is a Quaker school. We have a very comprehensive honor code, both academic and social, which enjoins students to treat one another with respect and trust that the students are going to behave in an adult and responsible way. I think that's at the bottom of basis for one of the reasons we felt comfortable moving forward. We have a great deal of trust in our students and the ability to act in a responsible and mature manner.
Well, that's Steve Water. He's Senior Associate Dean of Haverford College in Pennsylvania. He's also the Dean of Student Life there, talking about the impact of opposite-sex students sharing a dorm room, which is happening in about 20 colleges and universities across the country. Dean Water, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, learn something new every day, which, by the way, is our motto. How about you? If you have any thoughts on this topic or any topic you've heard on Here and Now, send them in. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give a call, leave a message at 617-358-0397. 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name. Don't go away. Still to come, deconstructing the staple of many dorm rooms, the Twinkie. You're listening to Here and Now. Its editor says it's a newspaper born out of tears. It's called the New Orleans Levee. Its motto is, "We don't hold anything back." Get it? Just like the levees. Here's a sampling of some recent stories. Mayor Ray Nagin declares the area's Broadmoor, the Lower Ninth Ward, and Lakeview to be the new axis of evil. Federal sources say the city will no longer be allowed to be referred to as the Big Easy. Instead, it will be referenced as the Little Difficult. And celebrity supercouple Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie confirm they are in late-stage negotiations to adopt New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin. Rudy Vorkapik is the editor and publisher of the New Orleans Levy. Rudy, do I smell onion?
Oh, you know what? To be honest with you, Robin, while I appreciate the comparison, we really kind of think of ourselves as more of like a print Colbert Report or a print Daily Show.
Because the Onion is completely satirical, yeah, right, online and now in hard copy newspaper. And you say that you do have, you know, whiffs of the truth in your articles. But, for instance, I'm online right now, and I'm looking at the New Orleans Levy, a story from a couple days ago. Mayor's Lego rebuilding plan proceeding along, that the New Orleans mayor is planning to rebuild significant parts of the city using Lego blocks.
But, you know, it's all steeped in truth because he's just not getting the job done and getting people back and getting things rebuilt. It's just, it's pulling teeth.
By the way, who built this Lego New Orleans that I'm seeing in these photographs here? There's a Lego Mardi Gras parade. This is fantastic.
Isn't it? I had been claiming credit for it just as a joke. I've said it took me hours. But the fact is that it's actually Lego has Legoland exhibits all over the country. This one's in California, and they have a little Lego New Orleans.
Okay, and in your newspaper?
In our paper, the Lego story becomes the mayor's rebuilding plan.
Well, now, you know, that seems like complete satire.
Well, you know, the thing is, it's steeped in the absolute truth, because it's more of a reflection of the sentiment down here. And that's what made that really popular down here. People are like, oh, my God. You know, the thing is, as silly as we get in this paper, we're always talking about what's going on in New Orleans in every single piece. And people are literally saying, you know, as crazy as it seems, that could actually happen. And
well,
that's the ridiculousness of the situation.
Well, there is a story out just today, a true story, a report that the Army Corps of Engineers installed faulty flood control pumps last year in an effort to meet President Bush's deadline of restoring the levee in time for hurricane season. The pumps are now being pulled out and repaired.
Well, you know, look at it this way. The Army Corps is replacing faulty levee system with faulty pumps. This is the way it's gone for us since 1969 when they started rebuilding the levees.
Well, and we should note that the Corps insists that the pumps would have worked if a big storm had hit, but still they're being pulled out and being repaired.
Well, right.
What did you think when the president recently visited New Orleans?
He didn't say anything. Unfortunately, that's the sad part. He came down and he wanted to remind us that he hadn't forgotten this part of France. He didn't say anything. He just, you know, he came down and he said, you know, I want to see the federal money move faster. You know, but you have to remember, too, I mean, and I'm not just federal government bashing. I mean, our paper spreads the blame exactly where it belongs, on each level of government.
You know, I got to ask you, I'm detecting Midwest in your voice. What's your, you know, passion for New Orleans? Where does that come from?
My story starts out like a lot of guys down here in New Orleans who moved here. There was this girl. Mm-hmm. And I met my now wife about 5 years ago at a crawfish boil. I've been coming down to New Orleans every year since I was in college, always in the spring, always for the greatest music festival, in my opinion, the Jazz and Heritage Festival.
Fell in love with the girl and the city.
Yeah, both.
Well, you know, and I'm wondering, too, I'm looking now, I'm on the page where the headline is a new law and order, NBC execs ordering a new version of law and order to be set in New Orleans. When a body is eventually found, halfway through the episode, police will fail to investigate it or will interview witnesses who will not comment.
All that story is a reflection of what's going on with our criminal justice system here. We have a completely dysfunctional criminal justice system, from the police to the district attorney. And on January 12th, 5,000 people turned out and marched on the New Orleans City Hall, voiced their absolute outrage that was going on, and that spurred thing. And everything that's going on down here in New Orleans is being done on the backs of the people and the public, with hardly any help, and there's so much going on. You know, this whole idea is born of a painful truth. You know, they say comedy is born from tragedy. Well, this should be the funniest thing on the planet.
Rudy Vorkapik, editor and publisher of the New Orleans Levy. To get to it, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Rudy, thanks for taking time away from the newspaper to talk to us.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now.
You get a big delight in every bite of Hostess Twinkies.
Okay, confess. You've probably had a Twinkie. Twinkies were invented in 1930 by a baker after he saw an ad for Twinkle Toe shoes, and they were once sold practically as health food.
With snacks, I look for freshness, wholesomeness, so I get Hostess. Mom's home!
Oh,
they just love that moist cake.
And creamy filling.
But what if she knew it was cellulose gum that gave the cream that smooth feel? Or the artificial and some say dangerous flavoring diacetyl that gives the Twinkie the taste of butter because, of course, the real thing would go rancid. Come to think of it, what the heck is in a Twinkie? Steve Ettlinger decided to find out. He's the author of the new book, Twinkie Deconstructed. He joins us on the line. Steve, welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, of course, the question that comes first is, why Twinkies? You know, why not Ring Ding, Snowball?
Well, you can't beat Twinkies. They are the archetypal snack food of America. They're even in a time capsule. President Clinton put one there.
Yes, and so there you go. Deconstruct the Twinkie for us.
The Twinkie is a cake, so it does have flour. Actually, it does have flour and sugar in it. Those are the two main ingredients.
Are those the only two sort of like real ingredients?
Well, I'm sorry to say there are a few more. Those do qualify as food. You have water, and you have things made from corn and soy, but they're highly processed. There's, I believe, by my calculations, 1/500th of an egg in each Twinkie.
And I understand that you got into this when your children asked you what polysorbate 60 was.
Yes, that's right. I was feeding them ice cream bars at the beach one day and idly reading the ingredient list like I always do. The kids, of course, wanted to know what I was reading, and I realized I started a slippery slope at that point when I said the ingredient list, and they said, well, what, you know, what is all this stuff? And I said, well, blah, blah, blah. And they said, well, what is polysorbate 60? And, of course, where does it come from? So as a dad, the only response was to spend the next 5 years researching the book.
And where does it come from?
Well, polysorbate 60 does come from a tree and a plant and an oil well. The tree would be the oil palm tree, probably, you know, on a plantation in Indonesia or Malaysia. The plant would be corn in the form of corn syrup that has been transformed into sorbitol. And the oil from petroleum would be cracked and made into ethylene, ethane, and then ethylene oxide.
Okay.
And, yeah.
I liked it better when you just said Twinkie. you find, 39 ingredients, a lot of processed food, and a lot of phosphates. Tell us about phosphates.
They're fascinating. The two phosphates here are used really as acids. They're derived from phosphoric acid, which itself is derived from phosphate rock. I actually went out to a mine in Idaho, saw them digging up this rock, which looks like dirt, from an open-pit mine, and they saw them convert it to elemental phosphorus. Do you know anything about elemental phosphorus?
No, go on.
It is truly amazing. They have what looks like a steel mill with giant piles of coke and silica, a half-mile-long rotating oven. It looks like a football field rotating. And it all goes into an arc furnace as hot as the sun. When you heat the three things together, out comes a gas which cools to a honey-like liquid, white, clear, honey-like liquid, which is elemental phosphorus and which bursts into flame if you pour it in the air.
Okay. Well, before we leave the topic of ingredients, is there anything else that you want us to know about what's in our Twinkie?
Yes, there are ingredients made from five rocks as raw ingredients in Twinkies. One is fairly common, salt. There's a phosphate rock and two other items made from rocks in baking powder, just the same kind of baking powder you have on your kitchen shelf, limestone, which is a source of calcium, and trona, which is the ore that makes sodium carbonate, the sodium source in baking powder. It also is used to make soda ash and bicarb of soda. So it's, and I saw that mine. It's a mine 1,600 feet down under the southwestern plains of Wyoming.
Huh. Well, we understand. Did you visit the company that manufactures Twinkies?
No, I wanted to. I went out to the bakery near New York in Wayne, New Jersey, which makes them for the East Coast, hoping to get in. And I called and called. They couldn't have been nicer. I spoke finally with a guy who has a great title. He's the vice president of cake. And he initially thought it would be fun and interesting, and then he called back and said, we discussed it here, and, well, if you want to reminisce about your childhood experiences eating Twinkies, you know, we'll be glad to help, but otherwise it's not really in our interest.
Is it like a top secret thing, you know, how they're made?
Well, there's a combination of things. It's not in their interest because people would be sort of aghast to get into these things. But there's nothing wrong with it. It's the stuff that's used in so many other processed foods. Another reason why the Twinkie ingredient list, which is the table of contents of the book, is a good choice. They're all very common.
Did you ever see that Twinkie that a science teacher said that he'd kept preserved for 25 years?
I didn't see it, but I heard about it, and I was thinking of calling him. I'm not surprised. I've kept a few around here, and except for the mice who get the fresh ones, they dry out and they sort of sit there. Partly that's scary, and partly, well, it's sort of like bread. You could put a piece of bread out, and it would last a long time. It dries out, but the cream filling does not spoil. That's pretty amazing.
Do you like Twinkies, Steve? I mean, did you eat a lot while you're doing this? Or
I ate a few, partly because I'm a food writer, so I believe I should taste everything, and partly because it's sort of appetizing when you're talking about it with somebody. Like I spoke with some flavor experts, and we tasted them together over the phone. We had a phone tasting, which is pretty racy, let me tell you, because we got oohing and aahing about it. But I practically always regret it. I'm not big on eating sweets, and they're a little too rich for me, too much oil.
That's Steve Ettlinger, who went deep inside the Twinkie in his new book, Twinkie Deconstructed. Well, speaking of taste tests, this segment was produced by our new intern, Huda Ahmed, who you may already have heard on Here and Now, talking about a much more substantial subject, Iraq. Huda is from Iraq, where she's a valuable reporter for the McClatchy News Service, but she's recently come to MIT through the International Women's Media Foundation, and we're lucky to have her as our new intern. Now, we thought we'd get Huda's international perspective on the Twinkie. Huda, first of all, what do you think that there is such a thing?
I didn't believe it when they said Twinkie.
The word itself.
I thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
At first.
Well, would you like to taste one?
Well, after I heard what he said, I will question that. But, you know, I've eaten everything in Iraq, so it won't harm.
Okay.
It won't harm me to eat something here.
Well said. Well said. After Iraq, what could a Twinkie do? All right. Well, here, you have one and I'll have one, okay? Now, what you've heard that, you know, while our colleague Alex just said that Susie Q's were much better than Twinkies, you've heard that, you know, many Americans eat this. What do you think of that?
Nest it.
Would taste it? Okay. Mm-hmm. Breaking it open, that's, yes, so you get the cream first. It's no devil dog, but it's good, huh?
Yeah, it is good, but I don't like so sweet.
Too sweet?
Yeah, it's too sweet, so I can't, you know, like, maybe it's a problem with me.
Oh, Huda.
But well, it's so similar to an Iranian product.
An Iranian product?
Yeah, it's the same thing. Like, we have an Iranian Twinkie there.
We do?
And we ate it, yeah. It's very similar to it. I ate it once, and I regret it. I said I will never eat it again.
Okay.
And I found it here.
Yeah, it's followed you. Well, Huda, welcome to America.
Thanks. That's the first thing I have to learn about, Twinkie in America.
A brief break from the news and from reality with our intern, Iraqi journalist Huda Ahmed, visiting MIT this year through the Women in Media Foundation. Next, we'll take Huda to a Dunkin' Donuts. Just kidding. For more on Twinkies, as if there can be any more, go to our website, here-now.org.
Hostess! A kid's world is a special world, and Hostess is a part of it. Hostess and kids, they go together.
Fresh, wholesome.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
A kid's world is a special world, and Hostess is a part of it. Hostess and kids, they go together.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.